In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, we're going to be talking about nurturing leads in your funnel, planning for growth, and how to buy a website. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 103. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
We're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. I have just had two cups of coffee, so this is going to be an energized show, but I killed 90 minutes earlier this morning troubleshooting a server configuration issue on Hittail. And when I was younger, I was in a few bands, played guitar and sing and stuff, and I learned that the best art comes out of like intense emotion. And so what I did is I channeled my anger over this server configuration issue and I wrote a poem. It's called An Ode to Microsoft Security Patches. Dear Microsoft, please stop resetting the permissions on my Windows temp. This is exactly why people talk about your operating system with such contempt. Your security patches broke my app again. I hope I don't ever have to go through this crap again. The worst part is that the patch was applied weeks ago, and now upcrops this error to spoil my workflow. A minuscule change to a single web page caused 90 of my precious work minutes to go up in a blaze. In retrospect, my biggest mistake was not assuming that the error message had been written to be intentionally opaque. The end.
Bravo.
Oh, the poem was like 3 minutes.
Oh, really?
Seriously, off the top of my head, yeah.
Wow.
No, I used to write songs, so like rhyming stuff was not a big deal. So yeah, no, the 90 minutes was focused on being very angry at a Microsoft security patch that resets permissions on a directory every time it runs. And like every 6 months we run into the same issue, and I finally documented it to the point where I'm not going to lose 2 hours next time, but it's frustrating.
Yeah, it's interesting because that's one of the things that is little known to people is that when Microsoft is running their patches, they have a tendency to reset permissions, and they use some, I'm pretty sure they use some sort of like kernel level stuff that goes in and allows it to change permissions no matter what so that the patch can be successfully applied, but it doesn't necessarily revert those permissions to whatever they were before. But that's something that we've been selling security and compliance software to people in the past, I've pointed out is like, look, permissions can get reset, and here's one of the ways that they can get reset, and that's what this compliance product can help you find out and determine whether those things have changed or not and give you a notification. So I highly recommend that you go to auditshark.com and sign up for the free trial.
Awesome. I will go do that right now. It would have paid for itself this month for sure.
And it would have let you know several weeks ago that that had happened.
Yep. Very good. So I heard you had dinner with our podcast editor last night.
Yeah, I did. It was a good time. We ended up going out to someplace in Manhattan. I forget exactly what the place was called. We were just talking, and she had mentioned to me that she's gotten so good at editing the podcast that when she pulls it up in Audacity, you know how there's all the graph of exactly what it is that you're saying? It just shows you like the wave and everything.
Uh-huh.
She can tell just by eyeballing it where one of us is saying either or you know.
That's awesome.
And she also said that if she would never survive the podcast drinking game if she had to use the non-edited version.
Well, yeah, that's brutal. I don't think people realize how poorly you and I actually speak before the editor goes through and edits like a samurai warrior. She's edited, 90-something of the episodes, right? I think we only edited the first 5 or 10.
Yeah,
that's
she's done a lot of them.
It's a lot of us to listen to in slow motion. Well, very cool.
Also, speaking of the podcast drinking game, Will Samuels wrote in to say that you should have to drink whenever Mike says essentially.
I'll agree to that.
All right.
I also noticed a few other tics that you and I have, and I'm not going to say them on the show because once I noticed them, it started irritating me whenever we do it. So there's an episode of Planet Money, which is one of my favorite podcasts. It's an NPR podcast, and it just came out today. It's episode 412. It's called How to Fix the Patent Mess. And they interview a Stanford professor who's written a book on software patents and the mess that it is. And he has some proposals for how to fix it. Awesome episode. Like first, I think it's the most, he's written an entire book on the subject. And this podcast was the most comprehensive view I've seen of actually trying to fix this. And one of the amazing things that he had said is, I think he talked to someone at Google or Motorola, and there's kind of just this number out there, and it's that the estimated number of patents that if you were to build a smartphone that you'd be infringing upon is 250,000 patents.
That's insane.
Yeah. And then they run through a bunch of the patents that are even worse. You know, you and I have brought up some of them, but there are some that are so broad, like voice over IP is patented, streaming of anything over the internet, anything, like any type of media file is patented by someone. You and I have talked about one-click ordering and that kind of stuff, but these are way worse. Like, these are true innovation-stifling patents that have been granted. Anyways, if you're interested in hearing more about that, check out episode 412 of Planet Money.
I wonder sometimes if companies like Google and Microsoft and IBM and Apple aren't just stockpiling some of these patents in order to help keep them away from, like, the legal trolls.
Oh, they absolutely are. No, that's why Google bought Motorola. I mean, it's pretty much widely known to be a patent defense operation. Like, they spent billions, I don't remember what they paid for them, $4 or $5 billion, and it's widely known, widely expected that that's why they did it, was to get they had a huge cache of patents. Money is not going towards innovation.
No, you're right.
It's not going towards paying people to build things. It's not going towards R&D. It's going towards having these documents sitting in a basement somewhere, so in a vault, so that they have it as defense.
Well, somebody gets that money eventually. It's got to go somewhere. It's not like they pay this money and then it just disappears into a black hole. You know, it's a financial system.
It goes to lawyers.
So I do have an announcement that I wanted to make. You and I have started talking about MicroConf 2013. So if anyone is interested in actually going to MicroConf, then you'll have to go to www.microconf.com, sign up for the email list, and you'll be on the first round of notifications for that. We do expect to sell out, so unless you're on that list, you may not actually be able to get a ticket. And then the other thing is that if anyone is interested in or knows of companies who would like to be a sponsor for MicroConf, just go ahead and drop me an email or use questions@startupsforrestofus.com. I'll follow up with you on the details.
I've been making a bunch of tweaks along with my small team of bandits to hit tail. We went from a 30-day trial down to a 21-day trial. I went in and mined some data and figured out that most people get enough hits within the first 21 days to make it where they can decide whether or not to continue with the service. And to be honest, we're testing stuff now. We're starting to muck with pricing and some other things. And it's just painful to wait 30 days to find out if your experiment is working, because then you shut it off and you have another 30 days of either good or bad that's going with it. You can't really turn the ship fast enough when it's 30 days. I'd love to get down to a 14-day trial, but I don't think I'll ever be able to. Anyways, for those out there who do have longer trials, when I first acquired Hittail, it was a 60-day trial, and I went down to 30 without too much issue. But if you have a trial longer than 21 or 14, I would highly recommend trying to get as low as possible. Just allows you a lot more flexibility.
Was that about the time you were, quote unquote, struggling to make freemium work?
Indeed it was, to quote the Wall Street Journal.
Yes,
very
yes.
Nice. The other thing we did that I'm pretty stoked about is we launched a 7-day long-tail SEO email course. So if you could just go to hittail.com, you'll see it in the bottom right. There's just this little like JavaScript widget, and it's performing well. I know it can do better if we optimize it. We're going to do some split testing of a bunch of stuff, but already it's picking up a lot of people who were coming and visiting the site once and leaving. As you know, 98%, 97%, however many of you, always have a huge chunk of people that come and just bail. So to get people onto an educational 5 or 7-day email course is a big deal. If you don't have one, you should think about doing it. It was a bit of effort, and it's why I waited until I had my new team member on board to be able to pull it off. But now that it's up, it's absolutely noticeable on our conversion rates and in just people returning to the site.
Cool. Where did you get that idea from? Did you pull it from what WP Engine was doing, or did you talk to Patrick McKenzie about it? Because I know Patrick's got a course that he recently launched on email lifecycle management, and I've actually been checking it out recently, and it's actually very, very good. It's got a lot of great information in that.
Yeah, no, it is a good course. No, I mean, I've done this forever. Remember my talk from BOS? It was all about this. It was all about putting an email follow-up sequence on your site. And it was an investigation of the impacts of it and stuff. So we've done this on .NET Invoice for years. I do it on Apprentice Lyman Jobs. It's been on my list since I first acquired Hittail and just didn't have the bandwidth to do it. And sure. Yes, I've also checked out Patrick's course. He gave me access to it. It's very detailed. A lot of good info there.
Cool. Yeah, about the only other thing I have is I talked to Liam Cavanaugh from Microsoft about data synchronization techniques, and I spent about an hour, hour and a half on the phone with him just talking about how to go about it, what I'm doing today, what sort of things I should be careful of in the future, and whether or not the Microsoft Sync framework is right for synchronizing data between the databases. And based on our discussion, I feel like I'm basically on the right track, but there are some of the fine points that I need to iron out, so I'm still working on that. But, you know, he definitely helped me along. So if anyone wants to follow up with Liam, he said he's more than happy to talk to people about data synchronization. So today we're going to start taking some more listener questions. And the first question comes in from Austin Rehorn. And Austin says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I'm a longtime listener to the show and look forward to it every week. I took the advice from your show and took my product to market last month. I've received a ton of interest, but nurturing and converting leads has been a struggle. My question pertains to marketing automation. You guys have spoken to this subject before, but Rob has been talking a lot lately about lead conversion ideas he has for Hittail, and I'd like to know what tools you're using. I'm a Hittail customer and love the product. I just signed up for the SEO email campaign, and I would like to know what you use to send these out each day. Keep up the amazing work, guys, and a belated congrats on your 100th episode. Thanks, Austin."
What timing? I just mentioned the Longtail SEO course, and Austin mentioned that. When I think about lead nurturing, like he's talking about, I actually think of two separate groups of people. And then there's a third that is after they buy. And those are kind of your customers in the first several months and retaining them. But the first two segments are people who visit your site and have not yet signed up for a trial. And then people who have signed up for your trial. And typically, obviously, that's a between 14 and 30 day trial. You want to keep it there. Both of those groups should receive an email follow-up sequence. With the first group who just visits your site, you try to have a nice looking form somewhere that pitches them on some valuable thing that they get by giving you their email address. And then you send them an email or five over the next several weeks and you educate them. You don't sell to them very hard. If you look through the Hittail email sequence, it is much, much more education, probably 80, 90% education. And then there's a short pitch for Hittail in like the third email and onward. But the first two almost have no mention or links to the Hittail pricing stuff. And the other thing is once someone signs up for a trial, most apps I know don't follow up with me very well. They typically say, all right, here's your trial stuff. And then right before I get billed, they might say you're about to be billed. And again, with Hittail, we have a very detailed, it is a lead nurturing system that depending on how many suggestions you've received, what you've done in the app, different kind of stuff, we look at your account and we send you a different email at various days during your trial sequence. Now that kind of stinks when I move from 30 day to a 21 day trial because I really do have to rework that. You know, I did a bunch of that last night. In general, for the front end, kind of just prospects that are visiting your website, we use MailChimp at this point. But I have to admit, one of my top ideas, if I do wind up branching out and building a new app, is to build something that helps with this problem. Because I don't think there is actually a good one-stop shop that can do this kind of thing. And so I'd say MailChimp's probably the best there is right now, but keep your ears peeled on the podcast if you're interested in seeing something similar to this. In terms of the free trial emails, if you can just do a simple follow-up sequence also through MailChimp, they have the autoresponder and follow-up area. But if you need to actually look at your data or see actions people perform and then send them different emails, you'll either have to custom code it or you'll have to use a more expensive system. There's a system called Infusionsoft that's a few hundred dollars a month. And I think Ash Mariah is working on one as well. It's called UserCycle. And it does a similar thing. It's for this process. Although, you know what? I think his is for that third segment that I didn't talk about, which is customers. Once they've purchased, it's about retention. And it's about messaging people who haven't done this or who have done this, you know, specific action, kind of like looking at their customer happiness index and emailing them based on that. I think the bottom line is, especially if you're still at the early phases of your product, you probably don't have enough customers to really worry about retention yet. And I think you're just going to want to go the easy route and look at MailChimp to begin with.
One of the other things that he mentioned in his question was what sort of tools do you use? And I know you mentioned MailChimp, but MailChimp is typically used for sending out mass emails or scheduled emails. What about when you had mentioned that you're analyzing how many keywords they get and then sending emails directly to them based on input data, I'll say, from your product? So how do you go about sending out those emails?
Yep. And that's like a console app that looks at the user's data and then sends it through Postmark, which we've mentioned numerous times on the show. But it's basically a service that helps with deliverability, and it helps you get insight into what emails are bouncing. And it shows every email that you send out of your system, basically, so you can track what's going on. And both you and I are hardcore proponents of Postmark, and I use them. I send thousands of emails through them every month.
Now, do you track I know that in Postmark, it will take a look at the bounce backs and stuff, and you can look at those. Do you have anything programmatically tied back to your application to identify those, or is it just you kind of eyeball it once in a while?
I eyeball it once in a while. Luckily, Postmark will not send to something that's bounced in the past. And so, one of the signs of kind of a bad spammy mailing list is if you don't keep your list clean, if you don't keep it pruned. And so if you keep sending emails to the same address and they keep bouncing, your list will actually, you'll start getting spam marks from web hosts and AOL and Hotmail and big email handlers. They'll notice that you're just sending a bunch of junky mail. And so Postmark helps you not do that. So even if I do have a big list of prospects and half of them are bouncing, that never happens. But if that were the case, Postmark won't send those emails. It keeps track of it for you. It's pretty cool. There's a small percentage that bounce back and stuff. It's not worth, at this point, it's not worth removing them from the database or anything like that. Because if they're in a trial and it's bouncing, the odds are that they're probably not going to become customers. And if they're a prospect and it's bouncing, the odds are they're not going to sign up for a trial. So I don't go through and prune those out now because, Postmark does it a good enough job. But yeah, I think if I was at a 10x scale to where I am now, then I would do like you said and probably monitor something and pull them out of the database.
Okay. So the bottom line to answer your question, Austin, most of this is custom tools that have been set up, but it uses online services like MailChimp and Postmark to send those emails out to people and follow up with them.
That's right. And by far the most time intensive part is writing the emails and thinking them through and crafting them and thinking, what do they want to hear at a certain date? 4 days into the trial, what should they be thinking? What should they receive? That's the harder part. Finding MailChimp or having some code that has a big case statement that decides when to send what, that didn't take that long, to be honest.
Now, do you take in, and I've kind of considered this in the past, but I've never actually gone down this road, but do you take into account what days of the week those emails get sent?
I don't.
Yeah. It's one of those interesting things when you're writing blog posts and stuff like that. You kind of consider that when you're going to post it based on when you think you're going to be able to get the most views. And in terms of deliverability, you want to make sure that people are going to actually see it and probably read it. But it can be hard to schedule some of those things.
I agree. I've seen a setting, and I don't remember if it was in MailChimp, but it was some mail management program I was using, and it said you set up a follow-up sequence or an autoresponder sequence, and then you could state only deliver on weekdays, and it would bump people forward or back, one day to get them to a weekday. So it was kind of an interesting feature. I don't know if that's in MailChimp, but if it's not, it's certainly something that I would use because people are going to tend to open B2B emails much more often during the week, basically during the work week.
Very cool. So thanks for the question, Austin. Hopefully that helps you out. And our next question comes from Michael, and he says, "Hi, I started my first company when I was 17, and I'm now just past 30, but I've not yet launched any online business. I'd love to hear your thoughts on which strategy to choose when launching several niche sites for the same product. As a couple of examples to set the scenario, books on gardening. You could have a site with gardening about blogging, and then you could target people who are looking for gardening or gardening tips. And then a second niche would be startups and entrepreneurs blogging about experiences, hurdles, etc. For a second example, using products for jigsaw puzzles, the first niche could be nature and wildlife themed jigsaw puzzles, the second could be large puzzles, and the third would be boudoir themed jigsaw puzzles. As you've recommended many times before, marketing to a niche is much easier. You get better SEO and better conversion if you target specific people. However, what are the advantages and drawbacks with using a single site with sections for each niche versus launching multiple sites? Large bookstores like Amazon and Barnes & Noble obviously have one book site with multiple sections, and this is probably the best way to go if you're big, but might separate niche sites be better if you're small, or is a hybrid approach better? The answer is probably it depends, but I think a discussion on what it depends on would be very interesting to hear. Thanks for a great show. Best regards, Michael."
So I think this would have been easier to answer 3 weeks ago. And the reason is 3 weeks ago, Google launched a new update that was called the EMD update, and it basically took exact match domains and dialed them way down in how important they are for your site's rankings. But more specifically, they said they dialed them down for sites that don't have a lot of authority. So they kind of implied that if you do have a site with a lot of links and it's obviously an authority site, then your exact match domain may still help you a lot. But if you have a site with very few valuable links and it just seems like you're kind of a small niche content site, a thin content site, and you happen to be ranking purely on that domain, sites are just disappearing off the first 20 pages of Google because of this. They may not be kicked out and they're not being penalized. They're essentially just reworking the algorithm. So 3 weeks ago, I would have said do many niche sites because you're going to want to get a nature-themed jigsawpuzzles.com and wildlifejigsawpuzzles.com and largejigsawpuzzles.com and go that route. But then you have 5 or 10 sites, depending on how many you launch, that you have to build links to, promote, build up the page rank, build up the link juice. And I think these days, I question if exact match domain benefit is still worth doing that. So I would probably test it these days because since things are changing so fast, I would consider getting naturejigsawpuzzles.com, but I would also get jigsawpuzzles.com, or obviously you can't get that domain, but you know, a different domain, put all the puzzles on it, because then you have one place to focus building links. You can create a lot of content there, and if someone comes, you can always do upsells and cross-sells pretty easily. But then I think if your nature jigsaw puzzles one, then more niche site took off, then I think maybe you'd want to, you know, lean towards that approach. But my guess is these days, it would be better if you did have related products on a single website. Now, I don't think this holds for software products, right? If you have 3 or 4 different software products that aren't highly related, I don't think you should just create a company website and have them all there, because there's a certain amount of selling that has to go into selling a software product. And having your sales website trying to sell 4 different products, it's just a mess because people come and there's no single call to action. They're kind of wading through all your products and trying to figure out what you're doing. Whereas with jigsaw puzzles, it's less that, right? Actually having a selection of jigsaw puzzles is much more of a benefit than when you have software and are trying to sell 4 or 5 different things. It actually, you know, tends to confuse people more.
I guess my thoughts are probably pretty similar to yours. Definitely for jigsaw puzzles, I would probably lean towards having a different website for each of those themes, I'll say. And then you can also cross-sell them between the different products. So like you can have basically a cookie cutter setup for all of your websites. So let's say you have 5 or 10 different niches for different types of jigsaw puzzles. They can be virtually identical, except on each of those sites, a single theme is emphasized. And then you can say, oh, and we also have all of these other ones. And then that way, regardless of which of those sites they come across, they still see everything, but you're allowed to essentially cross-sell the other types of jigsaw puzzles because they're going to be on that site and they're going to click around and they're going to look through all of the different jigsaw puzzles that are themed wildlife or nature or whatever. But they'll say, oh, you know, you can have this section that says other jigsaw puzzles or other themes, and people are going to browse through those. And you can kind of get that residual traffic without people having to actually go back into Google and leave your site to find another one that has, for example, large puzzles. I think that that would definitely help you in that case. But I think, you know, what you said, Rob, is exactly right for software products. It's a lot more difficult to cross-sell those types of things when those products aren't as well related. Most of the examples that Michael gave were, you know, for either books or jigsaw puzzles. Most of those are things that are easily repeatable and you basically put a different skin on it. Whereas with software, that's really not the case. I mean, Hittail doesn't come in red, green, and blue, for example. I mean, it just doesn't really matter. It's not material to the function of the product. And it's difficult to replicate that type of software in a new package.
Yeah, I think with certain types of goods, having a broad selection is actually a benefit. And jigsaw puzzles is one of those things, and books is another. And like we both said, with software, having a wide selection of software is probably, if you're a small operator, it's not actually that beneficial. It tends to be more confusing and overwhelming to a consumer who's trying to parse through to figure out, does this software really do what I want it to? Whereas if someone's looking for a jigsaw puzzle, they're just like, oh, it has a picture of Angry Birds. I'm going to get that.
So, Michael, I hope that helps answer your question. Our next email comes from Jesse, and it says, "Hi, guys. First off, I want to thank you for putting out the show every week and sharing your experiences. I've gotten a lot of insight as a listener, and I appreciate the down-to-earth approach you guys have. My question is that a few months ago, I launched a niche info product for programmers. It had some success, and now I'm working on a second info product. It will be marketed to the same audience, and the content will be of interest to the same audience. I'd really like to build a brand, offer more products, start doing training, etc. Should I put the different products on their own websites with separate domain names and hope that my name on the cover is enough to glue everything together? Or should I offer everything under one storefront with the brand name and show my repertoire that way? Really appreciate your thoughts on this one. Thanks, Jesse."
So a similar question here, but given that he specifies that the info products that he wants is kind of start a line of products that are marketed to the same audience and the content will be of interest to the same audience, I would probably approach this one with a single website, and I would have a featured product, big as daylight, right up, you know, in the top, in the header when people arrive, above the fold. That whole thing is your new product. We just launched this. Look at that. Here's your call to action. Please buy. That's the whole deal. And then down below, mentioning your other products, or on a separate page, you know, your other products page, you mention all the stuff you put out last year or, you know, 6 months ago or whatever. So you do have a catalog of your products there, and you can do cross sells, upsells, even downsells if you want. It's not you're not trying to sell 8 things at once. You really are trying to focus on your newest thing. But certainly each product does have its own product page, so that if someone decides they like it, they can tweet that individually. That individual product page could be go up on Hacker News if it got popular or whatever. So you're almost kind of building 6 or 8 little individual sales pages for each product, but your homepage is really promoting one product at a time with just cursory mentions of your other products in case someone wants to kind of sift through and look at your back catalog.
I think I'd agree with most of what Rob said. I would definitely lean towards having a single domain name and then somehow shifting people who have come to buy that one book into possibly getting them to buy the other one as a bundle, or, you know, having a couple of different bundles there if you start releasing more than 2 or 3 or 4 different products. And those bundles could obviously all be on the same website under the same brand. And the brand can help you sell more of those books or info products. And by bundling them together, you can get people to pay for all of them as opposed to paying for just 1 or 2 of them. I think I remember hearing that one of the best things that the author of Copy Hackers had ever done was to essentially split the book into several different books and then charge for each of them individually. That's another option for you, is to take the existing work that you have now and, you know, separate it out a little bit to, I'll say, generate more content, and then maybe bump the price down a little bit, maybe from $30 to $20, but have 2 or 3 or 4 different copies of it that people can buy. And oh, by the way, you can, if you want to buy the entire bundle, you can buy it for $40. And what that allows you to do is it allows you to raise the total price that people are paying, but on a per module basis, the cost is less.
I think you also get the benefit in that you're going to do a bunch of promotion for this first product. And if it's sold well, you're going to have just residual traffic coming in from all the links that you built and from people talking about it. And so if in a month you launch a brand new product and you put that above the fold, then people are, and it is related to that audience, then people are naturally going to be stumbling upon it. You're not going to start from 0 visitors each time if you were to create a different website for each product. And since you're not going after long tail SEO, it sounds like, I mean, you're not really going for that big wide berth approach where you launch 10, 20 different sites and try to just focus on keywords. I feel like the single site approach is definitely the way to go since your products are so interrelated.
So Jesse, hope that helps answer your question. Our next question comes in from Matthew. And Matthew says, "Hi, Mike and Rob. I was curious to know what your thoughts are about general liability policies for SaaS companies. My company, analystratings.net, does reporting on financial news. There's always a possibility that we could screw up a report and have a company get mad at us and file suit. How do you go about getting liability policies, and what would you look for when shopping?" Matthew, I think that the thing to recognize when you're looking at these liability policies is that what you should probably be doing is talking to an insurance broker, because an insurance broker can walk you through exactly the types of questions that you have and what the most likely scenarios are for that. The other thing I would do is I would probably leverage disclaimers pretty much on every single thing that you send. And I've seen them in all sorts of things, like all the investments that I've done over the years. There's on every single one of them, there's a disclaimer that says we are not responsible for typographical errors. And basically, when you go to an insurance broker and you start working with them, they're going to put together, especially in the case of like professional liability or general liability policies, they're going to put together a price quote that is directly related to your business, what you do, and how you operate. And they will typically ask you some very detailed questions about exactly what you do and how you do it and whether or not you have disclaimers for that kind of stuff. And if you don't, you can say yes and then change everything so that you do respond positively to that question. That's probably what I would do, but I'm not a lawyer. I'm not an insurance broker. Definitely go talk to insurance brokers. And a good insurance broker will actually bid your insurance plan out to multiple insurance companies so that you can get a comparable rate quote from multiple companies. Because what one company will provide you for insurance, the pricing may be almost the same, but the actual specifics of what they cover could be radically different. So you really have to pick through them pretty well and understand what your risks are and where you're vulnerable to being sued and what the insurance company is going to pick up if you are sued.
A lot of the questions that come through the podcast, I answer them with, it depends on your risk tolerance. And I think this is another one that falls into that bucket. But it does sound like analystratings.net does have perhaps a little more risk than some typical SaaS ideas. So, you know, if in the back of your mind, you are worried about getting sued and you are worried about not having some kind of, I guess it's E&O, right? It'd be errors and omissions insurance, something like that. I would absolutely do what Mike said and talk to a broker. I don't think you're going to need to pay that much to get several hundred thousand dollars in coverage. Again, it all depends on your comfort level of how much you think you could potentially lose in a suit. But if you have to pay $500 or $1,000 a year to get several hundred grand worth of business coverage, if that's worth it and that helps you sleep at night, then absolutely, that's something I'd move forward with.
So Matthew, hopefully that helps answer your question. Our next question comes to us from Graham, and he says, "Hi Rob and Mike, I'm a huge fan of your podcasts and blogs since discovering a few months ago and have been plowing through the archives every day during my hamster wheel commute. I'm a software developer slash project manager and totally connected with your comparison of salaried employment and consulting to the hamster wheel. From your episode 15, you mentioned a number of things to consider as well as places to find apps for sale. As this podcast is 2 years old now, I'm just wondering if these same techniques and sites are the best places to find apps for sale. I'm just getting my feet wet in this space and learning that as I'm searching for a SaaS app or website in the $500 a month range of revenue, I've been looking around for a while now, but my search has been empty so far. Thanks a lot, Graham."
For starters, I do think what we said in episode 15 still holds. Certainly there have been some updates since then, but in general, the approach is still the same. I think it has gotten more competitive. There are a lot more people talking about this kind of approach now than there were 2-3 years ago. You know, we were, I'd say, a bit of ahead of the game in talking about this kind of thing. So it just because it's more competitive, though, doesn't mean there still isn't money to be made. Now, most people give up on, you know, on Flippa or any other type of website buying approach because, number one, they aren't flexible enough, meaning that you have to be able to, if you find a good deal, even if you aren't super excited about X niche, if it's a good deal and it's something that fits your moral and ethical compass, then you need to be able to pull the trigger because that may be the best deal you see for the next 3, 4, 5, or 6 months. And I've definitely had to look long and hard to find every good deal that I found. So I think that's the first thing to remember is that it's not going to be something you go out and in the first week you're going to find some great deal and slam dunk it and be able to acquire something. So it will literally take months of education, and it's not like it's full time, but you know, you kind of have to make it a side gig to do this, to spend your time educating yourself on the process. The next thing I'd recommend is checking out an ebook written by a Micropreneur Academy member named Dave Rodenbaugh. And you can find that at websitebuyersguide.net. And basically, he goes through all the detailed approach that he used. He's bought a number of websites successfully. He sold a number successfully. He's really knows what he's doing when it comes to buying and selling stuff. And he had asked me maybe a year ago if I was going to write a guide like that. And I said, I just don't have the time. And so he went out and did it. I wrote the foreword to it. And I highly recommend it. It's the best guide I know about making decisions, doing due diligence, executing the sale, all that kind of stuff. It's very in-depth. If you really want to get into it, that I think it's, I don't even know, it's $30 or $40, but it's going to save you a lot of time in sifting through listings and that kind of stuff. The third thing to remember is, in my opinion, the best deals are made off of Flippa. And you may hear about an app on Flippa, But then you wind up contacting him after the auction ends and it doesn't sell and negotiating a private sale. Or you may just hear about him through other means. You just make it known to people that you're out there buying apps and they contact you. There's kind of these back channels. And when you're the only buyer, you're always going to get the best deal. While that last approach certainly takes more time and effort, in my experience, has landed me, you know, kind of the biggest and best, the highest quality sites that have turned out the best for me.
And along those lines, one of the things that you can do is you can start taking a look at different niches that you want to go after. And if there's a product that you have in mind and you start doing your due diligence on that to make sure that there is a market for that product and you start finding competitors, but they're not very good in terms of their SEO marketing and maybe their product is okay, but they're just not marketing it very well. You can go ahead and, you know, just directly approach them and say, hey, I would like to buy your app. Are you open to having a discussion about this? And in some cases, that's a good way to go as well, because then you're bypassing Flippa. You don't have to sit there and sift through a bunch of listings. You've kind of already done your due diligence in Google AdWords or various other tools to find out whether or not there is enough traffic to make something like that worth it. And you can figure out, is this a decent product that I can essentially just buy outright? Or is it something where it's going to take some time and effort for the marketing to kick in, but the product itself is solid. It's just they're just not doing marketing very well because they've got a development background and that's on their brain. So if you can identify places like that where it's something you are already interested in and maybe it isn't listed on Flippa, maybe the people don't know that they have an option to sell it, definitely approach them, because it's very possible that they're looking to get out from that particular product because they don't see it going anywhere.
Also, keep in mind that looking for a SaaS app is a challenge because most sites that are sold are just websites. They're not SaaS apps. So you're going to be looking for a needle in a haystack, and looking in the range of $500 a month is the lower end, and that means you're going to have more competition if one does come up for sale. It's kind of like in real estate. If you're looking for a single family home to buy, to rent out, or maybe a duplex, there's a lot of people in that market. But as soon as you get above 4 units, you start buying 5 and 6 unit apartment buildings, you have the money or the backing to do that, suddenly you have a lot less competition. So while I understand if you don't have the means to do that right now, that's fine, but keep that in mind down the line. If you can put together any type of financing, partner up with someone who has that kind of money, you can definitely open up to a less competitive and larger market.
If you have a question for us, you can call our voice number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsforthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes by searching for Startups or via RSS at startupsforthestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.